Good morning.
Good morning.
We thank you for your attendance. It does something for our ego. I'll give a little background. My name is John O'Neill. I am a staff chaplain at the Washington Corrections Center in Shelton, Washington, which is on the west side of the mountains. I am a licensed lay minister. I am not ordained. I have been involved in the prison ministry directly for the past 2 years, and this past week I've been here at the village discussing various aspects of the criminal justice system. Part of this program has been, we kind of loosely structured this and tied it together with Prison Fellowship, who is the Washington, Oregon State Director under Chuck Colson's Prison Fellowship, is Paul Meyer on my right. And on my left is Gordy Anderson, who is the property manager for Young Life. And it's my understanding it's kind of been a joint venture with a group that started hiking last Sunday. They came up lake with me a week ago today. They went to Stehekin, and I kind of sloughed off and came to Holden Village. They've had a real tough hike, and with them have been a group of young men who have taken advantage of this opportunity to a little bit of hiking and some opportunity to learn a little more about Prison Fellowship, about Young Life, with the culmination of coming into the village and experiencing the community, the Christian community, the loving community we have here at Holden. And it's been my perception that it has really been meaningful to them. I'll just mention the first names because I'm not sure of all the last names, but we have Eric from Young Life.
Leiter. Eric Leiter.
Leiter, okay. And
Bob Hinkle.
Bob Hinkle, also of...
he's our prison coordinator.
Prison coordinator.
From Tacoma.
I know some of these people. I've worked with them, but not that closely until this past week. Jay, Jay Meyer, Paul's son, Robbie and Willie and Joe and Mike. Where's Mike? He's back over there. They've all been part of this and helped make it a neat experience, certainly for me, and I'm sure for the rest of us. And I know there has been a lot of interaction in the village, and that's neat. And so we, at this point, I think just turn it over to Paul to give a little rundown on his aspects of it, and then I think Gordy and Eric here have a little to input, and then at that point we will pretty much open up your ideas, your opinions. There's no right or wrong. Here we are, and have at it. Paul?
Thanks, John. Really appreciate the support that John has given. We, John and I, started developing a relationship about 2 years ago, and we've just gradually gotten to know each other, and this time here at Holden Village has helped to make our relationship even stronger. And there's something about being here in the mountains and being away from the city that really creates a tremendous atmosphere for growth and for closeness. What we'd like to do is tell you a little bit about the two organizations that John mentioned, Prison Fellowship and Young Life, talk a little bit about the itinerary that we covered over the last 9 days or 8 days, and then some of the issues that we dealt with during this period of time, and then give you a chance to ask us some questions. Prison Fellowship is the organization that I've been involved with for about the last year and a half. And the organization was established in 1975 by Chuck Colson, and he spent 7 months in prison as a result of pleading guilty to a felony as a part of the Watergate episode, being on the White House staff, chief counsel to the president. Chuck felt a calling. He felt that he needed to sort of do something to turn his life around. He had been fellowshipping with several men in Washington, D.C. Doug Coe, for one. Some of you might know Doug. Those of you who are from Oregon probably know him because he started his ministry down at Salem with Mark Hatfield. And Harold Hughes, who was a state senator from Iowa. And these men began to minister to Chuck. And Tom Phillips, who is the president of Raytheon Corporation, had a significant influence in Chuck's life. Mere Christianity, written by C.S. Lewis, was a turning point for Chuck because it's his, trained as a lawyer, his logical mind sort of grappled with all those issues that Lewis was covering in that book. After he came out of prison, he felt a calling, the Lord calling him to do something with his talents. He wrote Born Again, which was a really successful book in a marketplace terms, but it gave several hundred thousand dollars to begin the ministry. He turned all that money over to the ministry and essentially was living, he and his wife Patty were living off of the earnings that investments when he was practicing law back in Boston some 20 years prior to going into government service. And he has continued to live off of those early earnings and turns all of his speaking engagement fees and the income from Born Again and his second book, Life Sentence, over to the ministry, which provide about 15% of the ministry income, and the rest of it is provided by contributions. The ministry began essentially in Washington, D.C. with a focus on taking men in federal prison back to a discipleship seminar to try to build into those men a sense of God's power in their lives, and then when they returned to prison to be discipling other men. Inmates discipling inmates was the concept. Over the last 6 or 7 years that prison fellowship that has grown, and as there are volunteers connected together throughout the United States through about 200 care committees, Bob Hinkle is a member of one of those 200 care committees working out of Tacoma. He has been coordinating our programs with the McNeil prison, which is now a state prison, used to be a federal prison. We have men and women throughout the country that are working inside the walls. We conduct seminars inside the prison. We conduct some seminars in the community where men can be released into the community for a period of 4 or 5 days. And we have really just begun to experiment with small groups. The seminars we've had have been 50 to 300 men and with maybe 25 or 30 volunteers. Inside the joint, inside the walls, with guards always there, present, with a sort of stifling atmosphere. But even with that atmosphere, God's presence has been there and honored that. So this seminar that we've just experienced is a sort of a new experiment. We did one last summer in North Carolina, taking seven federal inmates for a 2-week period, and into the mountains of North Carolina. And this is about the second time we've tried taking men out of prison. We initially wanted 10 men to be a part of our seminar, but when it came down to releasing those men from prison, the authorities became very, very uncomfortable about some of the men that we wanted, even though they're men that were really strong in their faith in the prison, that they were reluctant because of their time structure, because of maybe their one of them may have had an escape. They were a little bit nervous about that, and or for a variety of reasons, it came down to the four men that were released from prison in my custody. And this as my comments have certainly no reflection on these men. It's just the fact that there's sort of a mysterious process by which men are released to this kind of program, and we felt very fortunate that we were able to get four men, because the mood of this state and the mood of the country, because of the increase reporting of crime, because of the concern about some of the halfway houses and the parole programs where things don't go right. Normal parolee coming out of prison, well, 60% of the men and women coming out of prison will go back, will recommit their offense or violate their parole. We have found in our programs in Prison Fellowship, when we get connected with a volunteer, with a church, with a relationship, a loving relationship, that 60% drops down to about 10%. So it's a dramatic, the power of God working in the lives of those men, even though many of them are not, they don't profess to be Christians, although they're open, seeking, and they're starting their spiritual journey. There still is a dramatic change in that man or woman's attitude toward themselves and toward others, toward their sense of being responsible in a community. And so what Gordon Anderson and I did several months ago, we were introduced through a mutual friend. I felt that Prison Fellowship really was a babe in the woods when it came to going out and doing something in the wilderness, because there are so many risks involved in mountaineering. The weather, health conditions, food, safety things, that young life has had a track record up at Malibu and beyond, working in the coastal range of British Columbia. And I had heard about Gordon Anderson, and the reputation that young life has is just absolutely outstanding. And we began to talk about putting something together. And out of the contacts that Gordon had with the community, there were two corporations, Safeco Corporation and Recreational Cooperative, that donated some money to do this, donated a modest amount of money for us to make this happen, providing food and transportation and some incidental costs and equipment being borrowed from Young Life. And so this is a new relationship that's been established. And I feel that God has very much had a hand in bringing us together so that we can begin to build a network. And as I see more of the ministry in my year and a half, I see more of a need for Christian organizations to work together. Because working alone, we are at such a disadvantage because of the limitations that we have, but working together, we complement one another. And we have seen, I think, this happen this last week. And I'd like to then now turn to Gordy and let Gordy Anderson tell you a little bit about Young Life.
Thanks, Paul. Young Life is a non-denominational organization that was started by a man named Jim Rayburn back in the 1940s. He was a Presbyterian minister in Texas, and the man he's working for, I think the two of them talk, and they realize that a lot of kids weren't coming to church and weren't being exposed to Christ. And so one day he pointed down the street to the high school and he said, "There's your parish, and go get them." So Jim went down to the high school and began to hang around with high school kids and to earn the right to be heard. And he began to have what he called club meetings, because clubs were a big thing in school at that time, in people's homes, which were sort of a neutral atmosphere. And the organization grew, more and more clubs began to spread, and now the organization is pretty much all over the United States. And basically, we in Young Life are committed to the idea that kids, high school kids particularly, everywhere, have the right to hear about Christ and about his claims. And a lot of them at this point don't have the chance. And so we're, our particular role is to be out there with the kids, earning the right to be heard, and presenting the gospel, hopefully in a way that will be winsome and attractive. We basically present the gospel at weekly clubs, which would meet maybe in a community hall or a home somewhere. During the course of the school year, we have weekend camps where we will bring kids to hear the gospel over the course of a weekend, and also we have week-long resort camps. We have seven of those in the United States and Canada, and I have been attached to one of those, the Malibu Club, which some of you may have heard about, being from the Northwest. And my particular responsibility with Young Life the last 7 years has been to coordinate the Beyond Malibu backpacking program, which operates out of Malibu in the coastal mountains. I also supervise a couple of other programs, a sailing program in British Columbia and a hiking program in Colorado. And those programs have been focused pretty much on discipleship and retreat for Christian, although there are some non-believers who also are involved. And this week, I see Young Life as pretty much being in a support role with Prison Fellowship. And it's been a challenge to be involved and an enjoyable experience. So,
Gordy, I'd like to, you say Malibu. When you say Malibu, I think of Hawaii. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, there's a Malibu in California, but there's a resort started by a man named Hamilton, the fellow who designed the variable pitch propeller. I think it was in the 40s. And he had a vision to build a millionaire's resort, kind of a place where stars and millionaires could come in the coastal fjord region of British Columbia. And he built this California-style resort. There's a pool blasted out of solid rock that Young Life put in later on. There's a big lodge, dorms for kids to stay in, a golf course. They actually shipped in the dirt and built this golf course right on the side of a mountain. Early in the 50s, Young Life bought that for a real small sum. Hamilton just picked up and walked out one day and left it, and Young Life picked it up, and now we have turned into a resort for high school kids. So,
thanks, Gary.
John, let me just introduce Eric. He's going to talk a little bit about the day-to-day stuff in the seminar. Eric Leiter is a teacher from Lake Oswego in Oregon, and he's going to describe pretty much what we did each day.
Okay.
I have been involved in the Beyond program as a backpack guide for the past 3 summers, and that is how I became involved. Gordy called me and asked me. What I like to do is just paint or give you a visual picture, hopefully, of what some of the logistics of our travel was. We all started pretty much in Seattle and came over and stayed at the Lutheran Church in Chelan. At that time, that's when we passed out all of our equipment and kind of got organized that way. The church also there provided us with a kind of a gathering where the women of the church brought pie and ice cream, and we had a time just to pray and eat and kind of get started as far as having a support group at Chelan that was praying for us and just really supporting us and talking to us. And that was just a real neat experience. It's really neat to be part of coming into a body that you don't know anybody and just feel really warmed and welcomed. The next morning, we came up to Stehekin, where we started our trip. And this would be Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon. From there, we hiked up to Harlequin, which was about 4.5 miles, and that's pretty much on the road. We had our choice of taking the shuttle bus up or walking, and we chose walking just because we were eager to break in those blisters, I think. The next day, we rode the shuttle bus up to High Bridge, and from High Bridge, then we started our walk. Basically, what we were doing was taking a big loop from Stehekin all the way around and then ending up at Holden. The mileage that we hiked the first day was approximately 8 miles up to a campground called Swamp Creek. The next day was a 4 mile jaunt to Hemlock. The next night was another about an 8 or 9 mile hike up to Cloudy Pass, which is right up here. Some of you may have already been there. We spent 2 nights there. One day was spent hiking up Cloudy Mountain, just as kind of a day hike. And then we came down and arrived here Friday evening. We basically had all our meals organized so that each lunch and dinner and breakfast was in one bag that was already packed by someone who has been involved in the Beyond program, and that's how we have done it. So all the meals were organized that way. So when we call for a lunch, you know, the whole lunch was together. We brought 2 camp stoves, which we used only for the breakfast and dinner, and then lunch was a non-cooking meal. Tents we brought, we had, but we used them mainly for fly and mosquito prevention, not needing the rain prevention. The meals were important times for us to be together, to talk. Sometimes we spent time where we were able to go off by ourselves and just be quiet and eat our meal. We tried to have a consistent time where we could just have time alone to think about the day and setting our attitudes. Some people will call it a quiet time. And of course, quiet times can vary. Some people you can use an hour, or some people go 5 minutes, depending on the person. We were going 5 to 15 minutes in which we were just basically starting out with some kind of scripture that was being presented just to kind of keep our, just to give us something to think about, and then just really focusing in on the day, hoping that those attitudes that we were thinking about would carry us through the entire day. Um, think that's pretty much it as far as the logistics.
Okay, at this point I would like to thank you people, because whether you realize it or not, you have been supportive of this venture. Through the village, through your participation in the village, gifts, labor, help, love, care, whatever. The village has furnished the meals for the group and their transportation down to the boat. So in that context, you have all been a part of this venture, adventure, whatever you want to call it. And I want to thank you for that. And I want to thank Ellen Gamreth, who is chairman of the Holden Board, and John Schramm, he was up there, there he is, the director for, and Werner isn't here, but I've, over a lot of years, my wife and I have been associated with the village in various ways, and this is kind of like coming home because I haven't been up here. We haven't been here in over 2 years now. So again, thank you for your participation in this, I think, successful venture. I think everybody learns something. Do the fellows want to say anything? If you do, say anything programmed that way, Paul, or how do you want to handle that now?
Well, I think before we get into any kind of detailed discussion, if the men want to share, I've told them that it's really up to them to offer some insights to how they feel about the seminar, but I'm not going to put them on the spot. Before we get to that point, I'd like to kind of give you a little more information, particularly in the kind of questions that we dealt with. And Bob Hinkle, who is a part of the teaching team, Bob is a teacher, a math teacher in Tacoma, and under the Small World Department, as we were coming into Holden Village, just by the Holden Lake Cutoff Trail, Professor Herzog walked by and saw Bob, and Bob was a student of Professor Herzog's at Pacific Lutheran University, as was Eric, learned math at PLU. So it was a wonderful reception coming in to Holden Village to see him, and Ann Hafton was there, and Ann giving us kind of a rundown of what was for dinner, and it was just really it was a great homecoming. Bob, you want to give us an idea of what we covered and the issues?
One of the items that we dealt with in our time of sharing together was values. Just first, we would take some time to write some things down ourselves individually, and then get together and talk about these things afterwards. It's good to do some thinking on your own, and then it's also a good idea to do some sharing with others and get some interaction and to learn from other people. One of the other things that we dealt with, to give you another idea of what we talked about, was the highs and the lows for the days. And that didn't mean that the mountain peaks and the valleys that we're walking on, but the feelings that we had, the things that that were difficult for the day, and the things that were really high points for the day. And I think it was a very interesting thing for me when we talked after getting here to Holden Village. The day that we arrived here, nobody seemed to have any low points. It seemed to be a very great day. Everybody had just great feelings, real high feelings, and there were low points along the way as far as feelings, but everybody was able to come up with high points and low points, and these made real good discussions. I think that'll be all I'll say.
Okay, at this point, you have any input now, or should we just open up for some discussion?
Sure. Any questions?
Okay, why don't we just open it up, and let's hear from questions or comments, pro or con, or where are you?
I'd like to know who it was that organized the Prison Fellowship again. I didn't catch the name.
Chuck Colson, is that what you're, you mean locally or the in Washington?
Two of our organizers.
Charles Colson.
Charles Colson was the is the president of Prison Fellowship and began the ministry as a nonprofit corporation in 1975.
Okay, thank you.
Interesting insight. If you have not read his books, I would urge you to do so. It's kind of interesting. From my perspective, I read Born Again first, and then, of course, that was his first book, and then Life Sentence. And the span of time, the difference in those two books, which really, you know, there was a lot of comment on whether Chuck Colson was for real or not. You know, is this a deal to get out of prison, whatever. We deal with this all the time. And there was a lot of comment and a lot of conjecture as to what he was, really. And then you read his second book, and you see the fantastic growth in that man just in reading those two books. It's really interesting. It's kind of like he started out, and he was kind of he's starting to crawl like an infant, like we have to do in our faith. And then he was really in high gear in Life Sentence. So it's interesting. You might think about that.
I would like to say that I'm happy I came because I'm kind of interested in prisoners myself, and I think I pray for them almost daily. And I think the reason why I became interested, and several years ago, when I was, my husband was in the hospital, and I went out to dinner early, I forgot to turn on the lights. Our house was broken into, and we were robbed. And I came home and found the door was broken. It wasn't open. But the basement door was open when I opened it. I know I locked that. And then I closed that, and here the cupboard. And then the cupboard doors were open, and all the stuff was on the floor, and in the bedrooms. And I kept walking right into the house. And I was mad. I was really mad. I was much more angry than I was scared. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like the Holy Spirit spoke to me and said, "Why don't you pray for him? He has no interest in me." And I've been praying for this man ever since, and I prayed for the others. I have heard calls, and I've read his book. I'm reading some of Ray, Pastor Ray, the radio pastor, and some of the conversion experiences of all these prisoners. I saw the film not too long ago. And I think it's a tremendous ministry. But what makes it feel badly is that we don't start a ministry earlier. And we wait until people are incarcerated. Is there something we can do in families before this happens to our young people? Start some kind of a ministry or some kind of group or something for us. We have the church, but the church, we're not just doing what we are enough. Somehow we aren't reaching even our young people, the younger people, and parents aren't sending their children to Sunday school anymore. They are not coming. And then they just wander off. And
I think this past week I've dealt on some of those things. First of all, I thank you for your prayers. We appreciate that. It's very helpful, and it helps us. We have dealt on some of those things very directly. One, of course, is for me, I feel that the disintegration and the breakdown of the family unit is probably one of the primary causes of some our problems within our children. I would like to also say at this point that I didn't intend to mention before and didn't in my introduction. I am an ex-offender. I have been on both sides of the fence, so I come from some expertise. Some of it I learned the hard way. So I've dealt with these young men and so forth in a lot of ways. And for me, from the what I hear, when the records I am involved in, I see nothing but pain and grief, by and large, coming out of the family unit, the breakdown, the disintegration of the family unit. I also have to say that I am concerned about our so-called, quote, mainline churches, that we are sitting pretty much in a comfort zone. We don't rock the boat too much. We are not, we kind of pick it up where we say, well, we have a department or a bureau or a group or to do, to take care of these people, so therefore I can turn it over to them and forget it. The unfortunate thing is that most people have forgotten that 98% of the people that go into prison come out of prison. Now that's a figure you want to think about, because what happens is they go in. We have very, very few, if any, programs to give them the tools or the motivation to help themselves. And they come back out angry, bitter, and consequently repeat. We say as a society, hey, you have paid your debt, so you're forgiven. And we say that loud and clear. The only problem with that is we don't live it. That person is marked and rejected, by and large. That's something we have to look at. I think the only place that we're going to start to deal with the problems that we have in our institutions, the fantastic amount of money that you're investing and getting no return, has to start in our churches. And I just challenge you with that one. That when you go back to your own congregations, your own communities, whatever your particular faith may be, which whatever denomination you may belong to, that you, in your conversations, in your discussions, that you might think about some of these things. Because if you were in business and you invested your money the way it's being invested in the criminal justice system, and you didn't get any more returns than you're getting now, you would be up in arms, believe me. You would be up in arms. Something to think about.
I'd like to pick up on this question there. Concern that you expressed about families and children. When a family, there are 340,000 people that are incarcerated in the United States right now. 340,000 people throughout the United States are in some kind of a lockup situation. You can multiply that times 10, because for every, when a man or a woman goes to prison, that family goes to prison with him or her. Children, uncles, aunts, close friends, relatives are all incarcerated. It affects everybody. Just like a divorce in a family, it affects everybody in that family structure. We're finding in the ministry, as it grows and matures and deepens, that we need to meet those problems, those desires for fellowship with families. We're spending more time now with families, with husbands and wives. We're doing some marriage seminars, both inside the walls and outside, where a man can be released, where we have a couple working together. We haven't involved children yet, but I have several cases where the man has divorced. He has lost contact with his wife and his child or children. And in order to make him, when he becomes a Christian or becomes a God-seeking person, he wants to go back and heal those relationships. And what we're finding more and more is that we're getting in the business of helping in that reconciliation, to find that person first. I have several letters out now trying to track down wives and children. And because a man, when he changes his heart, he wants to go back and spend time with that child or with that even ex-wife, to even to the point of saying, I'm sorry, or do something to help support that family, because once that child is there, it requires some support. That's becoming a larger part of our ministry. And it's also, as John pointed out, when a church takes on a family, one or two families or maybe one or two inmates that have come out. The nature of that church changes. My home church is the University Presbyterian Church in Seattle. And we're a large enough church where we can take some inmates, ex-inmates in and help them. And it has a tremendous effect on the church, taking that a faith which may be kind of wishy-washy, kind of, you know, abstract, and where the rubber meets the road, when you're dealing with problems of prisons, you've got to deal with your faith where it's going to make a difference. And I know that talking to the men, my faith has been deepened this week. I've been challenged. I'm in the business of reconciliation. I'm a mediator and an arbitrator, which is a part of my profession. And I have learned so much. This has not been an easy 9 days. It's been a tough, tough week. And we've gone through some knotholes, and we've knocked some heads together, and we've had a tough struggle. And I've learned a lot, because I think through the pain of that reconciliation, we've tried to structure some time and some exercises, and we've been met with resistance. And I've been accustomed, because my military background and sort of Teutonic demeanor, I just, you know, said do it or else. And the men have, in some instances, have said no, we're not going to do it. You're not going to push us around. You may have us out here, you may have our bodies, but you don't have our souls yet. We've had to do some tough negotiating, and I think that out of that I have come closer to understanding what Christ felt.
If the men are willing, I'd like to hear some of their responses to this experience. What, you know, if you're willing to share it, what you got out of it, or high points for you, or
as soon as you stop. That's Willie. He'll share it.
Don't fail me now.
Okay, I'm Willie, right?
Wilderness Willie.
Wilderness Willie. I'll get to that point. Now, I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and there's not as much woods in Cleveland as it is in the middle of this pit here. I'm from Furlands Correctional Institution. It's a small institution in Seattle.
Minimum security.
We have very minimum, right? And our head administrator there, he's a real nice guy, and we got maybe advantage over some of the other guys because we can be kind of personal with him. So he, in turn, asked me about coming out here on this trip with Paul. And to me, coming from the city, like I was saying, I knew nothing of the woods, mountains, or anything, right? So it was just like, I don't know if I'll like it, but I hear so far away, if I get out there, if I don't like it, don't make no difference, I can't get back, right? So, you know, I'm feeling like I'm going, either I'll come back and say, hey, hiking is all right, or hey, don't do it, you know? So we got out here, started hiking. Even the boots appeared strange to me. So we hiked for 4 or 5 miles the first day, slept outside, and I was on animal control, of course, you know, just told me, call me if any bears or anything like that. Next thing I know, we was up on Cloudy Pass, right? I think I was having I wasn't having a hard time, but it was a little higher wall to get over to Garden here. You know, we, like they said, we had little conflicts up and down, you know, but it was all part of the experience. That's the phrase they always got me with anytime it was something to do. That, oh, it's part of the experience, so that means I have to do it, right? So we went up to Cloudy Pass, and we climbed the peak. Is that the name of the, that's what they call it? Okay, the Cloudy Pass Peak, right? And when you get up to the top, you kind of got to put your whole lot of trust in the other guy, you know, because he got a rope tied around him and you, and if he let go, you might be gone. So it's sort of like kind of a, you know, like instant friendship. I mean, all of us. I mean, all those little ups and downs, you know, you forget all about it. Right, sure, you're the best guy I ever knew, you know. But, I mean, just to be up there was, I mean, really an experience for me. And we left there, and we, on the way down here, which we knew nothing about, we knew nothing of this holding trip. That's why you probably have to excuse some of us, we're kind of dirty and stuff. But, you know, that's all we knew, we was just going to be out in the woods. They didn't tell us the good part. So we went down, and like yesterday, we went to the day before. On the way down here, we stopped at Lyman Lake. So a few of us went on and took a little, maybe a bypass or something, maybe an extra 3 miles added to our little journey, and went up to the glacier. And this is where me and Gardy came upon our real friendship again. He challenged me, and I guess it was sort of like, well, I felt like it was like a let's do it now or don't do it situation, because he knew it was something that I didn't want to do. He challenged me to dive out in the water and climb up on an iceberg and take a picture with him. Don't get me wrong, now, I didn't mind the water out of the iceberg, but I had to take a picture out of it. So, I thought he was joking. I mean, we was just standing on the glacier, and they saying, don't look here, don't touch there, you know, don't you fall in this hole here, and you never be found again. He stepped right off, he said, you want to dive in, you know what I'm saying? Well, okay, you're just kidding, right? I'll give you a little laugh, and we keep on walking. He got Eric on his side, though. Eric's looking at the iceberg like, wow, you'll never get a chance to do this again. Before I know it, he in there and on top of the iceberg. I said, wow, it can really be done. He's sitting on it. He's as amazed as me because he challenged me knowing that I wasn't going to do it. Now Eric done it and I'm taking off my shirt. Bluffing, but he don't know it. So then we get undressed and it gets serious. I mean, just being naturally lazy people, you know, it's like, wow, we done got undressed now for nothing. We really got to do it now to just make undressing worthwhile. So, I think I took the lead and stepped out there and kind of chickened out and backed up, which he was very well pleased with. And then Eric told us how to do it. He said what we was doing wrong was we were thinking, right? You know, you don't think when you do something like that. You got to do it, get back, and then think how crazy you was. And so we eventually got out there. But again, like when I was on the mountain, one of the things that changed me, I'm going to have to kind of slow up right here a bit. You know, like I said, I came from the east all the way here, and like my thing was like, trying to get money all the time, you know, and I felt like that's what I needed to have fun, right? And this trip kind of let me know that I don't necessarily. I mean, like the same way when I was on the mountain and Paul was tied to one end of the rope and I was tied to another, you know, just to show me this experience of being up on his peak. And at the same time, you know, I was thinking like, well, he has to, I mean, he's trying to protect me, but at the same time, if I fall, he may not be able to hold my weight. You know, so he's taking, like, really a giant chance also, you know, just to show me, right? He just met me. But the same thing happened with Gordon when I led out again to get on the iceberg. It was kind of slippery getting up there, so I finally made it, and then he came behind me. And I was standing on the iceberg, standing there. Now, Gordon is like twice as long as me. and weighs, you know, I'd say maybe 1.5, probably, you know, my weight. And I'm standing on a cube of ice. and he's trying to get up. And he's slipping, and he reaches his hand for me. And I'm looking at his hand like, what am I supposed to do? You know? I mean, I don't have nothing to grip onto. I'm just standing here, right? But right then in that instant, you know, I didn't know if he was fearful. I knew he was cold. Whatever. I mean, he may have could have even stood up in the water at that point. You know, I don't know. But I know he wanted to get up on the ice on the ice cube with me. So I mean, all of my logical thinking, which I was wrong for doing because Eric had already told me not to, was saying to me now, he outweighs you by a ton, you're standing on ice. If you let him grab your hand, you're gonna be back in the water. I mean, that was just, I mean, everything I ever learned in life, that's the only way I could have envisioned that incident ending up. But for some reason, the expression on his face was saying, it'll work. So I stuck my hand out there. You know, I had to block out the thinking again. And when I stuck my hand out there, he grabbed it, and he started coming, and I started moving. I don't know. I don't think either one of us, but some kind of way he ended up on the iceberg, right? And I know, you know, that just right there, the challenge, the whole thing, and just the way it happened, I know it was help involved other than me and God. And at the same time, I think it sort of developed our relationship to a point that it never would have came to without that particular incident. And so not only has the trip turned me into Wilderness Willie, as they call me, but it's shown me that I can actually, you know, enjoy myself and have fun just more or less like naturally or without being rich or just busy, you know, at something. I mean, at times I was so busy trying to get something that even when I had something, I didn't have time to enjoy it. You know, and then after all these things happen, then we end up at the end of the trail here with you people. And I don't know, you know, like, this might seem strange to you, but imagine yourself being someplace like this, and it was all black people, and you were the only white.
That's scary.
But you know something? What's scary about it to me is that I'm probably the comfortablest person here.
Thank you, Willie. Appreciate that. We've got just 10 more minutes to interact, questions, whatever. How about any of the rest of the fellows? Robbie?
My name's Bob. Everybody calls me Robbie. I may not have as many words as Willie does. But this has been one great experience for me. Had a lot of lows. Had a lot of resistance, especially for me. And this place here, just the past 2 days, has really let me see light to a lot of things. I didn't know there was this kind of people left in this world. And I don't really know how to express it, because I don't know. I just never had to before. So I always put a wall there. I come to conclusion, you know, I think my wall's going to start breaking. And, I just want to thank everybody, you know, for being the people you are.
Thank you, Robbie.
You've expressed it admirably, very well. I don't think any of us could have done any better. How about it? Anybody, any of the other fellows want to speak up?
Well,
Okay, John? Or Joe?
I came from McNeil Island. And I just want to say, you know, this is an experience, you know. It's been really great for me, and I just want to say thank you.
I think I'd like to... I'm not sure that you people understand the courage that it takes to speak out, like Willie and Robbie and Joe have done. Share where they are, what they're dealing with. And I hope you really understand the courage that takes, because it does. It takes some guts. Okay? Yes?
Let me say just one more thing. While these guys have been here, I don't know them real well yet, but I've spent a little bit of time with them. And as a Christian, I think I know I've grown a lot. And I would like to express to these guys that when they go back, I'd like them to know that our prayers will be with them. And I'd like to tell you that I love you, God loves you, and I thank you personally for the experience you've given me.
Thank you.
Crying, so.
Mike, did you...
I'd just like to say thanks to everybody. It's given me some time to go up here in the mountains. Maybe we didn't have a lot of studying about the Christian belief because we had conflicts, but even though we didn't, I had a lot of time to think. And, you know, just being up here in God's wonderland, and, it's given me a lot of chances to think, you know, being away from the temptations of everyday life. And coming here, it was kind of like a dream. You know, I didn't, like, you know, the rest of them, I didn't know a place like this existed. And I've been doing some talking to some people, and I kind of, if at all possible, someday like to come down here and spend a couple years, maybe get closer to God. You know? Because I have places to go on, you know, house. I've, parents are, you know, Christians, but I don't know if I want to go, you know, right away out on the street again. You know, because it's hard for me to, you know, think out there. Because, you know, like, you have the pressures of saying when you were in prison. And the people, you know, a lot of people out on the street aren't like people in here. They do look at you like, you know, I don't know if you're trusted. You know, I just like, you know, say thank you for being the loving people that y'all are.
Thank you, Mike. Well, we have 5 minutes. Yes.
I'd like to ask the Prison Fellowship representatives what volunteer capacities there are.
That's wide open.
Well, I'll say that.
Grab that
question. I love the answer. There are four areas in which we're working in this ministry. The first area is correspondence. To write to a man or a woman in prison gives them continuous support and love, and a friendship that helps to strengthen their own faith and gives them a feeling of, you know, somebody cares. The second area of ministry is we do seminars inside the major prisons twice a year. This year we'll have one probably in Monroe, Washington. I'll have one down in Salem, Oregon, about the middle of October. I have another one in McNeil next spring, Shelton, hopefully again this spring, Walla Walla. We'll have another one probably in December at the penitentiary. And if you live in those areas within a 50, 75 mile an hour radius, we have training sessions that train you, to prepare you. We have ordained ministers that are teaching the seminars that are from around the United States. Some of the best teaching I've seen. And it's an area to be inside a prison and be in a group and be fairly secure in that. The third area is when a man or a woman comes out, to be involved with them, to give them that cup of cold water to help them in terms of finding jobs, place to stay, and just being a friend and tuck them into your church so that there's some fellowship. The fourth area of our ministry is family. Women need to continue a relationship with their husbands with their wives. Many people are on welfare because of, you know, the income. They need transportation to a prison. They need to have the children cared for, and they just need some fellowship. those are the four main areas. We set up our correspondence to Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to be involved in any aspect of the ministry or wants to know more about it, you can give me your name and your address, and I'll send you an application, give you some material. I didn't bring any with me because I was trying to keep that bloody pack as light as I could. But I'd be happy to correspond with you, and I'm sure that Gordy feels the same way about Young Life. If you want to know more about Young Life, you can contact him. But I'd welcome the opportunity for any of you that may want to be involved in the ministry. There are just many, many ways. There's a fifth area that has developed, is emerging since the Walla Walla riots in 79. And that is the whole question of reform, because the first area to be cut in a budget is social services and prisons. And the medical area, dental area, the care is miserable. It really is. And we need to hold our public officials accountable. We need to keep their feet to the fire to remind them of these men and women that are incarcerated, so that they don't get the dregs. They don't get the short end of the stick. The medical area is one area that's been cut, an educational program. Willie was involved in an associate's arts degree, and they cut the program, they cut the funds. They cut the community college funds. They've cut areas like that. And I think we need to be collectively a pressure group. We formed an alliance this last legislative session. I went to the Council of Bishops of the Catholic Church, and I went to the Association of Churches, Washington State Association Council of Churches, and we formed with Prison Fellowship an alliance to lobby to make sure that the reform bills that were passed this last session, that they didn't just simply lock people up and you know, throw away the key. We've got some things, we were able to get some things written into the legislation, and we're working in other states. We have Dan Van Ness, who's an attorney from Chicago, on the staff, and doing some really effective lobbying at all levels, legislative level, at the federal level, with congressional people, and it takes letters and support. The whole concept of penitence that was started in Philadelphia by the Quakers, we've lost that concept. We've lost the it's tough for volunteers to get into prison. It's tough for religious organizations to get in. And there's some organizations that are in prison that are dangerous, that call themselves Christians, but they're really cults. They're just dangerous to be there. They do more damage than they do good. And these men have been, these men, if they had the time, could tell you about some of the crazy people that come into prisons. We need wholesome, together, loving people to show what Christianity is all about.
Okay, I, at the very last, I'd just like to leave you with one sobering thought. Excuse me. And that is that we do have failures in the system. We do have failures of men who come out. And maybe we should look at why we have failures. Maybe we should look inwardly. Because by and large, a person can only be rejected so many times, and you can't handle it anymore. And that goes for all of us, whether we're coming out of prison or whatever we're involved in. We need to be accepted. We need to be loved. We need to be cared for in one way or another. And you can't go through life being rejected. When a person struggling to make a new life is continually rejected, he's eventually going to slide back to his comfort zone, which by and large are the people he dealt with before he went to prison, and winds up back in again. So we do have failures, but we have to look at why we have failures. Our Lord Jesus Christ tried. Unfortunately, there were some who did not hear him. And I think there's no way that we can play God and say that we are going to save them all. We struggle, we try, but we have to be ready to accept the failures, and there are many. But if we would really look at why we have these failures, I think we'd get another picture.
John, Willie wanted to say something.
Okay, I will let Willie. Go ahead, Willie.
Okay, I just wanted to say that, you know, for myself and the rest of the guys from the institution, and then guys that's in institutions that's not here, you know, we really appreciate your concern. I'm saying this basically because this is something that me and Gordon have been through, and Eric, for 2 or 3 days about people and their concern, and I was one that really felt that if it was none, right? And I think Paul like hit it on the head when he said, just you being pooling together to become a pressure group is more or less what's really needed. I mean, no money or nothing like that. Just to let them know that you're there, you know, just looking, not necessarily just to put the inmates, but the administration, you know, to let them know that you're looking at what's going on, so that, like Paul was saying, some of the programs won't be cut down, and then some of the guys will be able to do things when they get out of the institution, and they don't have to turn to crime. You know, but as long as nobody's paying any attention, it's going to get worse instead of getting better. So I'd just like to thank you all for the concern that you do have, and I'd like to thank you in the name of every inmate in the state.
Thank you, Willie. Appreciate that much. And thank you much for coming. We appreciate your interest, and just hope we've left you with some things to think about when you go back to your home congregation. Yes?
I've heard this last hour the men saying thank you, and Paul saying thank you, and different people saying thank you to the Holden community, but I would like to, as maybe someone from the Holden community, to say thank you to the men for their sharing. And I think that if you think that you've received from us the last 2 days a great deal, I think that we can say that in return, that we've received as much or more from you. And I just want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.